I'm going to just pose one question to each of the speakers before opening up. Paul, let me ask you a question. You said that you implied that corporations are the solution, or your corporation may be part of the solution. How do you answer to those people who say that corporations are the problem?
Well, I say you've just listened to the last speaker who says governments are the problem. So I've moved on. I've moved on significantly from that, and I say why don't we put all of our energy on the solutions? You open newspapers and they dramatize the 10 or 15% difference. We are 80% the same. So why not build on these commonalities to create this better future? In fact, the most important goal is goal number one, which is to alleviate poverty. We are just lucky to be born in this part of the world, lucky to go to LSE, lucky to be financially independent. That's not true for 98% of the people. So if we are in that position, let's put ourselves to the service of them. And increasingly we realize that's actually a good thing to do. The costs of not doing it are becoming much higher. Think about the refugees coming to Europe now or some other things. So it's not anymore time to say governments are doing this or business is doing that or NGOs are doing this. It's to say what can we do together on a common agenda, which is goal number 17, which is partnership. It's not just partnership of you and I are going to work together. It's a moral partnership for the common good, knowing that if we would invest in others and give, we would actually receive more. So if we can bring this level up of morality and not just finger pointing, we get there. Einstein said the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. Part of the challenge that we have in this world is that we work in silos, and the same in companies, by the way. So if we can break that by working together at a different level, most of the breakthroughs that I focus on in terms of getting out of deforestation or helping nation states to be built or whatever the bigger sustainable development agendas are, where we are seeing the progress is because people work together. And if there is a definition of leadership, the true leaders are people that put the interest of others ahead of their own. That's really what leadership is. And indeed, they are at all levels of society. It's the medical people that go to West Africa when there's Ebola, knowing darn well that they put their own lives at risk. But it's more important for them this common good than themselves. We have the Gandhis or the Mandelas, but it's the teachers that at the pittance of a salary are going to schools to teach people. I work a lot with the blind and deafblind. The people that work with the blind and deafblind, often it's 24 hours that they need to give care to someone at a salary that we wouldn't even think was possible. But they do it because they're interested into advancing the cause of the common good. And actually they realize very selfishly that by giving that, they will be better off themselves. Enormous satisfaction comes from that. So we need to drive that agenda together and not really have the discussions of what people not do. If people behave differently, let me tell you, I haven't met any CEO. I know there are companies that are not doing what I think they should be doing. That is no doubt about it, let me be very clear. But I haven't met any CEO in the world. And if you meet them, please send them to me. But I haven't met any CEO who wants more unemployment, who wants more air pollution, who thinks it's better to have more people go to bed hungry. I don't think they are there. People are basically inherently good. There are some abuses, like anywhere in the system, but people inherently are good. That's why we are here on this world. So what makes people behave in a way that doesn't give us the results we all want? Often it's not the people themselves, it's the boundaries in which they operate. When a financial market is very short-term, people are behaving short-term. When our accounting system, we were talking with two wonderful ladies coming up in the elevator here, when the accounting system only values the financial accounting and not the social and environmental, we only focus on the financial accounting. The moment we put a price on carbon, we are starting to go after carbon and reduce that. So the boundaries of our system are actually driving our behavior. And it is these boundaries that we need to move. And for that, we need to be all together. When I talk in the UK, for example, with Cameron or others, we say, what do we need to do to move the UK economy to green energy? It's not that people don't want to. It's when you have a perforce subsidy, let's say, on fossil, then you prevent people from moving. So move these boundaries away. What is the boundary that we need to move to get people to value these externalities which are currently not valued? We start in the UK with a law now that makes it compulsory to have carbon disclosure. Any country that already forces carbon disclosure sees more progress than if you don't. What do we need to change in boundaries so that we get economic growth that doesn't benefit the capital market only, but also benefits the people that actually do the labor and the work, which is really an issue here why you see these income disparities. Mm. So focus on these boundaries together is really what I'm preaching, and not to be judgmental. There is no right for any of us to judge others if we don't ourselves put ourselves 100% to the service of others in the first place.
Okay, I'm going to ask Alec one question. Alec, you started off with a very interesting little autobiographical sketch about being quite sceptical and maybe a little bit cynical about the UN when you first encountered it, and you became less so. How will you feel if the next General Secretary is a man? In other words, you know, the proof of the pudding is not what you say, it's what you do. How symbolic will it be for you, or indeed for many people working in the field, if they see that it's just yet another man who becomes UN General Secretary?
Oh, you're not going to like my answer.
How do you know that?
Because I would not mind if it were a man if he had the merit to be sitting in that position.
Okay.
I think that there's a lot of discussion about having women presidents and prime ministers and secretary generals, etc. And for me, I think probably because of where I was raised and how I was raised,
sure.
I think it's an inevitability that we will have a female secretary general. But I would like for it to be somebody who has merit.
Mm.
And so there are men who have put their names forward and women who have put their names forward who have merit. And if it were one of them, I'd be happy. When we get to, I'm just going to go back to the part where you
sure.
said I'm less skeptical about the UN.
Well, I got a little bit of impression, little less skeptical.
A little less skeptical, that's fair. I think I have to agree with Paul that it's about the boundaries that have been created. But I think we have to recognize that just because this has been a UN more or less created agenda, it's not going to be a UN-led agenda. It won't. The UN does not have the capacity in and of itself to be able to do this. The UN is a bunch of member states with their own interests. It is a political machine. It is not
sure.
there out of, you know, some ethical or moral. It should be, but let's be realistic, it's not. It has as large a military budget as more militaries around the world, right? So I think we overemphasize the value of the UN in this conversation. It's definitely one of the partners in that Goal 17, but the bulk of this will come from member states individually. But also, if you look at who governs the space in your own country, oftentimes it's no longer your actual government. Corporations have a huge hand in it. Media and technology companies have a huge hand in it. They have more information than many governments do. So those all have to be very key parts of that conversation. Academic institutions, which research and create cutting-edge ideas, are going to be a huge part of it. But to think that this is going to be an agenda that the UN can lead, and I would argue even in the next 15 years maintain, I wouldn't bet on it. I think we have to start now in 2016 saying we need to create partnerships that are sustainable for the next 15 years, that include governments and emerging actors that can actually really create those new boundaries that you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, one final question then for Funmi. You talked a lot about security, Funmi, and very movingly, and you gave some great examples there. I'm about to ask the question, who will deliver the security you think is an absolute precondition? I mean, is it going to be local forces? Is it going to be the UN? Is it going to be Western interventions? Where does that security come from? And who delivers it?
From the people who live in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
But that security in the end will come either non-violently or violently. And we're already seeing the conversation that takes place between people and their leaders. Sometimes we, the UN, are present in that environment. We're completely helpless. But look at the conversation that took place in Egypt. Although the end result of it is what it is now. It's not really what those who stayed on the streets and wanted out of it, because they wanted greater security and a more secure future for the 60% on that continent, in that country, which is the same all over the place, that more often than not is under the age of 30. Look at Burkina Faso. It was people who took to the streets to argue for the kind of security that they wanted. You can say that of Tunisia, but unfortunately you can also say that of Somalia, of Nigeria, of Northeast Nigeria, and other parts of Nigeria. Violent conversations are taking place. over which the United Nations has no control and cannot even claim to deploy troops, nor can it even deploy troops successfully. Mm. I think in the end, people will have a say, and it is they who will maintain a secure environment for themselves. Mm. The Sahel, the corridor from northeast Nigeria all the way to southern Algeria, depending on what you're looking at, or to northern Mali, is another example where you can see that there's a divergence, complete divergence between what governments are doing and what people are doing. Mm. So you can actually see regional security clusters in which people think that porous borders are a source of security because they have to crisscross it and they have done that for centuries. But their governments think maintaining tight control over borders is where security is because they're thinking terrorism, migration, just like Western countries are doing. But their people are thinking security in terms of markets, local markets. Every border, it's very interesting if you cross the borders across West Africa or the Sahel. On the other side of the border, every time is a market. Mm. And people are in search of livelihoods. But then you close the border for people who have moved, crisscrossed those boundaries all these years without those artificial borders, trying to protect themselves for ecological reasons and for reasons of trade and sustenance in general. So there's a dynamism that is going on that we have to recognize, which will invariably cause us to change, to acquiesce to the kind of security that people are asking for.
I'm just going to piggyback on that, because I think there's always an assumption whenever we talk about local leadership, particularly in peace and security, that we're asking for somebody to create something that isn't already there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I want to clarify that if you imagine any conflict in the world, right, the reason that the global community can take such a long time in addressing it is because the schools are still running. It's because water is still running, electricity is there. It's because local leaders have maintained some sense of normalcy in the worst type of conflict, something that in many of our societies we wouldn't be able to do. When Canada gets a blackout for an hour, people are rioting. Like, being realistic, the local leadership exists. It's just a matter of bringing that local leadership to a policy-making table, of giving them the agency and institutionalizing their input, which is something that we haven't done. And it's been clear, it's shown to be ineffective, because within 5 years, 90% of our peace processes absolutely failed. So it's about taking the local leadership that already exists. Nobody is saying, you know, unicorns and rainbows. Taking the local leadership that already exists and just giving it agency.
Great. Okay, I've opened it up for some discussion. Why don't we start beginning to take some... Yeah, somebody over here. If you stand up and just... Sorry, shout as loud as you can. Thanks. Could you pass the mic back there?
I'm a master's intelligence designer at Rockefeller. One of the projects we've been asked to focus on is the impact of plastic bags bringing in all the money. And so the question I have is...
Okay. Well, I think that's partly directed to you. Others want to pick it up.
So, as I mentioned before, accountants actually will change the world. We need other people as well, but accountants. I wouldn't feel very depressed if I was an accountant. I would actually feel very optimistic, because you have a key role to play. If we don't change the way we measure success in this world, we are not going to solve the issues. We measure in many places self-worth by net worth. We measure a GDP that actually doesn't take quality into account. We don't measure peace, we don't measure quality of education, we don't measure quality of air that we breathe, we don't measure safety. So we need to, if we want to create an inclusive global agenda like the SDGs are, we also need to change our measures of success. The same in companies. When companies, which are basically a country's GDP, is not different from a company's P&L. So in a world where we cannot use too many more materials, we have to start providing different incentive systems. So some people call this redefining value, including an environmental and social P&L next to a financial P&L. If we would move in that direction, and the faster we do that, the more we will drive behavioral change, one of these boundaries that will change. A good example now here in the UK is Mike Carney, who is from Bank of England, And he's asked Michael Bloomberg and others, that happens to be that our CFO is part of that, on the financial disclosure board to see if we can actually get a better understanding to the financial markets of the risk of climate change in companies by having companies publish more, extending the definition of what success looks like. Mm-hmm. By exposing that risk, you'll drive behavioral change, very much so. Some people say we treasure what we measure. And if we don't measure that, we don't treasure that. Now, a capitalist is not a bad word, despite what some people think. A capitalist is someone who optimizes its return on capital. But if we define capital also as environmental or social capital, then the capitalist is very well placed to solve a lot of the issues that we have here. But as long as we live in a world where a tree that is dead is worth more than a tree that's alive, we're not going to solve the problem. So accountants change the world is not actually, hopefully after what I've just explained, something that is just a slogan. It actually has to happen. And many people are working this topic. And again, the question is not the direction of it. The question is how, what speed can we move? Because it's obviously very complex. Even on the normal accounting, we can't agree between different parts of the world. So this is a complex issue. But the more people get involved, the more we work together on these initiatives, the faster we can move. And the accounting firms, by the way, are in my opinion, under investing in this area, whilst you would expect that they would be the first ones to jump on this. Very limited leadership from them. Universities are not the most active in this either, whilst you think a lot of intellectual capital could come from there. So we need to step up the efforts there to accelerate it.
Just one little aside on that, Paul. The beginning of academic accountancy, I hate to make the point, but it started at the LSE. And one of the reasons it began here, amongst accountants here, some very interesting people, a man called Arthur Bowley, and the reason he wanted proper accountancy at the LSE was because he could better measure poverty, understand what poverty meant, define the causes of poverty in order to better to eradicate it. It's kind of an interesting way in which accountancy and social political goals got connected together. One thing's in different ways. Okay, let's pick up another question. Thanks for that. There's a question there with a man with a hat on. Yeah. Hi, man with a hat on. Please. Yeah. Hi there.
I'm a prospective master's degree at the Warwick Business School and Human Scholar. Between 2011 and 2015, Germany will open 10.7 gigabytes of new coal burning plants in order as aftermath of Fukushima. And just today we could read that French EDF is having second thought of building Hinkley plant, nuclear plant, as the zombie said, although the Chinese government is the third of the project. So having that UK government policy to provide private companies to build new generation of nuclear plants, we've seen that financial cost of building these plants is very difficult to meet for the private sector, which you mentioned that should be driver of the new generation of the wave of technology and renewable energy. So given the UK is on path of austerity, as most of the world, as well as country which recently achieved the leader position of the renewable energy consumer amongst the world countries, can you tell us anything on the new views or even trends which tackle the financing needed for this new renewable generation of energy production which we need, as well as what would be the role of UK in sustainable development goals which needs financing in order to be achieved, and lastly, what is the next big thing in the renewable energies but needed on national levels in order to support the communities and energy which we need as nations.
Right. I counted about five questions. Very, very, very good. You should become a politician. Okay, I'll pick up some anything else. Let's go around, maybe take a few more. There's a gentleman here and a lady in front. Yeah, please, sir.
My name is Noor. I work with an NGO here in the UK. My question is relating to, well, the sustainable development goals are great, the good statement, then, but how do you bring in accountability between the UN and the governments? Mutually, and I know in some countries the countries do not listen much to the UN, and in others UN totally patronizes them. That's one question. And second question is, you talked about leadership and institutions. They're good, but if the UN itself is paying 50 times higher than a government bureaucrat, then how do you make that leadership into the government? You know, when the UN in some countries deplete the governments out of their human resources by bringing their staff and recruit them, how do you build that? You know, is there any reforms on that area?
Great. Okay, and yeah. Take this the last one. Yeah, please. Yeah.
My name is Ilse. I'm a former LSE student. I have a slightly broader question. I really like the trend about sort of people are inherently good. 2015 was a great year. There's lots of leadership shown in business, in lots of areas. And I have a question about to what extent do you feel that sort of the general public also connects with that? I sort of have to think about, and this is slightly political, so you don't have to react to it if you want, Brexit or Donald Trump gaining lots of popularity. So I was wondering how you think about that connect between sort of high-level leadership.
I hope we would get through the evening without mentioning Donald Trump. Sadly, you can't do it, I'm afraid, or even Brexit. Why don't we start at the end of the table then? Why don't if you want to have a kick at one of those, see how it goes, then move on.
No, I think the question around how you bring mutual accountability between the UN and states is an interesting one. And I think the message I was trying to send is that when you have the UN take the approach that it has taken in the last two decades, the same approach all the time towards, say, for example, conflict-affected states, you will not be building mutual accountability between the UN and that state, assuming state, you know, government and the whole of society. You'll be building accountability between the UN and a small group of cronies in those countries. And that's the heart of the problem. And I wish it was possible for me to say it differently. If we want to research and say it as it is, that is the single most important challenge that the UN needs to alter and alter rapidly. Why? Because the credibility of the UN is already being affected in many places where it operates for precisely that reason. I think the leadership and institution thing is also related. That therefore, what you want to do is build institutions at all costs, by being accountable, by building a relationship only between you and the local leaders, regardless of how much those people are abusing, those leaders are abusing the rest of society, you cannot really go far. Leadership for me represents something that is much more fundamental. It is something that you find in society. More often than not, you don't even find either the UN or the leaders in that environment exercising leadership. Leadership is being exercised in terrains far from the center of, you know, of activities, and we never really acknowledge that. And actually, I would say that the one way in which the UN can transform what it does is to begin to look for those things that are happening outside the realm of the state that are being replicated across society, and a way to leverage that. The best thing we can do in the end for ourselves as the international community is to use the leverage we have with local leaders and use it positively. More often than not, I've seen many of my colleagues who would say we don't want to offend the government, we don't want to annoy them, and so on and so forth. So therefore, we become part of the problem ultimately that needs to change.
Thanks. Hello?
So I'm going to cover the last question first, because Donald Trump is one of my favorite topics. No, I'm kidding. But in all seriousness, it's interesting, because Donald Trump is actually more a sensationalized media caricature than anything else. He's gotten 30-40% of less than 20-30% of the Republican vote, less than 2-3 million votes in total, right? You could look at the other older white guy who's also creating a lot of sensationalism, which is Bernie Sanders, who is my personal favorite, obviously, because I think we could just replace capitalism with socialism and call it a day, but that's another story. But my point here is that a lot of where Donald Trump comes from, and a lot of the people that support that, a lot of the rhetoric that you're going to hear on the front page is an overamplification of a very loud minority. And another example I'll give of this is the survey that was done recently here in Europe about how many people would accept refugees, where over 75% of people said they would. Right? That's not something that you hear in political circles. And that's because politicians, unfortunately, do have to cater to a very conservative group. I come from a region where that is a daily truth. Right? So I recognize where your question is coming from, where when we have this rhetoric happening at a high level, how can we create some sort of correlation on the ground? And I think what we need to be able to do is we need to become as savvy and as smart about amplifying our voices. Mm-hmm. We need to make it clear that our voices matter as much. Mm-hmm. And because the U.S. was mentioned as an example, I mean, Donald Trump has never gotten 27,000 people in a park. Bernie Sanders has. So we need to start creating media where it's there, because that, to me at least, shows that there is an overwhelming public urge to do better and be better. Even if not for, and a lot of people in this room may not feel it because we come from very comfortable backgrounds, but for a large part of the world, it's gotten to the point where it doesn't matter if you're doing better, as long as I get to do better as well, that's great. And that's why you can get that many people in a park. So it's really about amplifying the voices of those who need it the most. And that is the majority of the world right now, right? Because we talk about how we've taken people out of poverty and we still fail to recognize that means living on $2 a day. It's a joke. So we need to start amplifying those voices. We need to start making sure that we're actually speaking with people around the world and getting those voices out. But I do think the general public supports the Sustainable Development Goals. I think that's apparent based on, I mean, all these new vegan and sustainable living things that everybody's doing. It's become hip to care about the world. So let's keep that momentum going. Take the Instagram pictures about how you're eating well and recycling. The second thing was, where's the accountability? We have to remember one thing about the UN, in my view, and that is that the charter is we the people. Right? Everybody in the UN, every single member state is elected by its country. Most, that's unfair, not every single, but most member states, especially the ones that are paying the big bucks, are elected by their own citizens, right? And the United Nations is meant to represent the citizens, not the governments. So it comes down to citizens themselves to, A, become more aware, because for many people, they don't really pay much attention to the UN. Most people have no idea what's happening at the UN. If you ask an average person what the different structures, the different decision-making bodies within the UN are, they don't know them. And that becomes a problem if you are interested in getting involved in things like sustainable development, or if you're having the expectation of some sort of international global body which will push for it. The second thing is the brain drain that the UN and a lot of international NGOs take when they come into conflict-affected countries or countries that are developing. And that's not just the UN, and that's also the brain drain happens when you have people going from one country to another, migrants who are looking for better economic opportunities or looking for better support, right? So it exists in both senses, and I agree with you, it's exceptionally frustrating, having been from a local organization where the UN did take the vast majority of our best abled, but I also think it comes down then on, because a lot of the local organizations, speaking from personal experience, get their funding from other member states, right, or other international funds or foundations. And the budgets they're allowed to ask for are much less. Even the UN, when it pays locals, pays around $4,000 less per month. So we need to start asking ourselves about whose work we value and why somebody who doesn't know anything about the country, has a foreign passport, does not have the same access, the same knowledge, the same history of the country, gets paid 10 times as much. We need to start asking ourselves why that is broken down like that. Because if they were paid the same, those people would not be going to work for the UN. If they were given the same benefits, if they were given the same support to work on local initiatives, they wouldn't be doing that. But it is because their work is not valued and their voices are not valued. So that's a much larger question about development and the way we fund it and the way we view people, right? And the last one is money in the age of austerity. I always find it funny when we ask about how we're going to pay for things. We were talking about this before. Because we seem to pay for, like, military as if there's no tomorrow. We pay for wars. Those never become topics of conversation. Bringing up, you know, Bernie and Trump, when people say his ideas are completely preposterous, how is he going to pay for all of them? It's about a reallocation of funds. It's about prioritizing what actually matters. It's about saying, it matters more that everybody in the world eats than us just bombing people and creating more mouths to feed. The money is there. I'm sure Paul can answer this question with many more numbers, like how much was it? 9.7 trillion. So you just need to take 1/3 a year, right?
Paul, over to you.
Yeah, so it's we spent 9.7 trillion on wars and conflict, dealing with the effects of conflict. 9.7 trillion, this development agenda, 2 to 3 trillion a year. So we spent 1/3 or more in some countries on the healthcare cost, treating obesity. The biggest pandemic or epidemic that we now get is diabetes too. We spend very little on prevention. So we have to move the system. Our systems are very reactive, same in companies and everything. We then quickly pass laws or rules or regulations. We very seldom have the time to go to the source. The reasons politicians are not getting into this as much is a tragedy of the commons, of the longer term. We discount the longer term too much. A political cycle doesn't go beyond 3 months nowadays. So the reason you see Donald Trump, he gets a lot of attention in the US, but there's a Donald Trump in every country. I'm from the Netherlands, where we have a party called the PVV, which is pretty scary as well. In France, you see Le Pen. So why is that happening? It's happening because more and more people feel that the system isn't working for them anymore. And in the US, that's the white middle-class man, who actually hasn't seen his income progress since 1980. In fact, some people would say, in real purchasing power, they're down 16%. So then it's easy to say China this or NAFTA that and all the other things that are coming up. So these populists, which are basically against people, they're basically against people without any constructive ideas of what they have, become the only escape route. Because they say, believe me, I'm going to make the country great again. Mm-hmm. You see it in Russia or you see it in... And it becomes a nationalism of the highest order at a time that we actually need to be more working on a global joint agenda than ever. So responsible businesses is, again, not the only solution, but I'm just focusing on where I can make a difference. Responsible businesses that are global, have a more longer-term perspective, etc., need to actively get into the political process with others to de-risk all this. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. That's why you see many companies now, including ours, stepping up our presence in this Brexit debate. Not because we want to get into politics. We want to be sure that this world functions in the long term. But any economic system where too many people feel they don't participate or are excluded will ultimately rebel against itself. We talk about goal 16 being the most important goal. It is. But the interesting thing of the way we constructed the 17 development goals is that they're all interrelated. There isn't the most important goal. You cannot have peace without development, and you cannot have development without peace. These things go hand in hand. So the beauty of these goals is they're all interrelated. And they are not anymore goals for developing markets. They're global goals. There's as much poverty in this country or stunting or malnutrition. In fact, most poverty now are in intermediate countries in the world. So coming to the question of coal, if I may, so it is disheartening any coal plant that is being opened, but there are actually more coal plants being closed in this world right now than opened. There are 21 countries already in this world that have decoupled their economic growth from environmental impact. There are cities now, compacts of mayors and all the other things that are coming in. Just in the US right now, the only investment that is being made is in fossil-free energy, if you want to. And Paris sent an enormous signal. What business wants is certainty. When business needs to invest, they need to know if that investment, that the risk is taken away by getting a certain direction. If there is no clarity, business doesn't invest either. Before Paris, there was no clarity if the world wants to decarbonize or not. After Paris, there's a little bit more clarity. We've seen the investments pick up. We've also seen countries accelerate. It's very interesting. So some countries indeed have still coal factories. India actually is the main challenge because they have cheap coal themselves. They have actually a high cost of financing that makes a lot of the other alternatives uninteresting. That's one of the reasons why the world has created the $100 billion Green Climate Fund. That's one of the reasons we are together in coalitions that we are creating to figure out blended financing to take the risks away from these countries and invest in alternative energy. And that is happening rapidly. It's not happening yet at the pace that we wanted, perhaps, but we are talking about a trajectory that has a few more years. In the US right now, just in the last 2 years, 57 coal companies have gone bankrupt. And the biggest one, Peabody, just recently. That was a company 10 years ago that thought Al Gore was Pinocchio and was telling lies. Now you don't hear them anymore. In fact, Al Gore was telling lies. I always tell Al, you went true when you made your movie Convenient Truth. Because the projections he had in that movie on the cost of energy, etc., coming down and the transformation, were way too conservative versus what is actually happening. He undercalled it. So he was lying to us. But the coal companies are rapidly. The biggest transformation that is happening, which we shouldn't underestimate, unfortunately or fortunately, is when the financial market gets involved. Because business reacts to the financial market because they're basically the shareholders still. And shareholder primacy still dominates in this world. Too much in my opinion, but it still dominates. So what is happening? In Paris, we were trying to get 100 billion together of divestiture movement. We ended up having 900 billion divestiture movement. Many, by the way, university endowment funds are part of that. 900 billion in Paris is now, and Paris was only in December, it's now 2.7 trillion already. We have 24 trillion of capital under management is calling for a price on carbon. Because the investor community sees, hey, there's an issue. What is the biggest issue that we have? That the world has agreed to stay below 2 degrees, and that all the fossil fuel that we have discovered already, we don't need any more discovery. So anybody who's drilling, you should oppose that. There's no reason to drill more, because all what we have discovered, we cannot use 2/3 of it if we want to stay below 2 degrees. So many of the assets are on people's balance sheets as stranded assets. So finally, the financial community is getting worried. So you take the biggest private fund, sovereign wealth fund, which is Norges from Norway. Mm-hmm. Norway has earned a lot of money in oil, but they've put $1 trillion in the investment fund. It's called Norges. They have made a decision to divest from carbon. So the ball is rolling. And many companies, if you look at energy companies also in Europe, also your German examples, and you look at German energy companies, if you would have invested 5-6 years ago in any of these companies, your money is now at best worth half of what it was when you were investing there. The market is folding with their feet. Let me give you one other quick example of how the market is folding with their feet, and I'll use our famous friend Elon Musk from Tesla. Elon hasn't sold any cars yet. He sells about 50,000 cars. In fact, the Tesla 3 that just came out, he got orders in 1 week time for 325,000 cars. But he hasn't sold, you know, a few hundred thousand cars. General Motors sells 9 million cars a year. Tesla already has half the market cap of General Motors. Half the market cap. If he has half the market cap of General Motors, with barely selling any cars versus General Motors being the number one producer, what it tells you is the financial market is starting to fold with their feet on where they see the future is. So in the US it has become, unfortunately, a political debate, because the parties have to differentiate themselves, and any issue has become a political issue. But climate change, first of all, is a human development issue, is not a political issue, in my opinion. People accuse me sometimes of being left, or others say I'm too right, whatever. But climate change is not a political issue. It's a human development issue. And the second thing is that now in the US we're starting to see, and you'll see changes happening after the election, whoever wins, but you'll start to see that the US is starting to realize that it's actually good for their economy to get involved, that it's not a political issue or a way for China to slow them down, or, you know, some of the noise that Trump makes. That people are starting to realize that's in fact where the jobs are being created, that's in fact where the economy is being powered by. So in the interim transition, where we still have some countries investing in coal, which is unfortunate, or where the UK is dilly-dallying on the nuclear plant, which by the way provides 20% of their energy, they cannot decarbonize if they don't do it. Because at the same time, by the way, they've pulled subsidies from wind and solar, unfortunately, in my opinion. But on the positive side for the UK, just to balance my story, the UK, Germany and Norway have just decided to put 5 billion in a fund to help fight deforestation. So the story is always a little bit more holistic, and that's why these, again, the sustainable development goals are there. There's a goal on forests, there's a goal on climate change. Sometimes you compromise on one a little bit to make it bigger on another. If the world would reforest, we lose about 12 million acres a year of forest, half the size of Belgium every year, which are the lungs of the world, by the way. We forget that sometimes. But we now have, in all of the goals that came in Paris, we have about 30 countries with reforestation goals for the first time. If we spend a lot of money on that, we buy ourselves a little bit of time. If we keep cutting the forest, we create a problem a little quicker than we would like to. So again, a good example of where you cannot judge a country on one individual act, but you have to look at the integration of the goals, and that is the most difficult thing. What is the biggest challenge is, frankly, the consumers don't know about the Sustainable Development Goals. We're all sitting here because we go to LSE, we happen to have passion to work. I actually have a lot of sympathy for the UN, because I think it's the only organization now globally that was able to put out a moral framework, whilst the rest of all the organizations failed to do this. But then it's up to us, as you heard from the fellow panel members, to make it happen. At the end of the day, it's people who is making the difference. But if you go out there and you ask people what are sustainable development goals, if you ask businesses what are sustainable development goals, you're lucky if 2% of the world knows what we're talking about here. Now, they know that they have a problem that the water table has dropped for a few meters, or that they can't breathe the air, or that more children have asthma. They know that, but they don't know the Sustainable Development Goals. And that's perhaps not important. What is the most important thing is that we drive the system to take the actions for, in fact, the people who can't take care of themselves. That are, unfortunately, too many. And that's why you don't need to have the whole world do this, or all the people on the ground. You need to have enough critical mass of responsible people that are going to help that. Local communities are not going to solve your coal plant issue, for example. You understand? So you need enough critical mass, I think, from responsible businesses, responsible civil society, responsible governments to drive these changes. And it needs the young, because unfortunately what is happening is that the young are more concerned than ever now, but they are more removed from the political process than ever. So the biggest rallying cry I would have to you is get involved, cast your votes. In every country now, in the U.S., interestingly...
Or run for election.
Or run for election would be the better one. But in the U.S. right now, the millennials, 78% of the millennials know that we need to work climate change, need to do all the things, everything. The millennials don't see this as Republican or Democrat. They now, for the first time in the history of mankind, have the same amount of votes as the baby boomers do, who frankly don't care, because they're protecting the status quo because it served them well. Few exceptions. But they don't go to the polls. They don't get involved in the political process. So get involved in one way or another is the most important thing you can do.
While we're saying that, make sure you register for June the 23rd vote. Because it's going to be up to you guys to make sure we have a rational outcome. I've got three here. I'll take one, two, and three, and four, and five. We'll take a group together at the front, yeah. Okay. One question per person.
Okay, one question. Okay, I
have
two questions.
I know, but one will do.
Hi,
great.
My name is Ruko, also from Royal College of Art. It was really interesting to hear about how the ground-level mobilization and how young people can... the change. I've got one question. So, like young millennial people who go into large organizations with a consciousness and interest for sustainable development goals, how could they change the organization from like bottom up change before they're kind of silenced by the company culture and kind of lose motivation?
Okay. There's another one up here. Yep, please. Yeah. Just stand up, please. Yeah, please.
Thank you very much. I have a question. You talked a lot about security and how it helps to meet the sustainable development goals, but giving the power to local communities and local governments. But as we can see, the history tells us that it actually can sometimes. Oh, sorry. The history shows us that. That history shows us that usually it can backfire, giving the power to local government. And I would somehow like you to connect the power of companies and how companies can get involved in securing certain parts of the world if there is a possibility.
Okay, great. I have another hand over here. Yep, one. Yeah. Somebody in red behind you. Yeah, okay. Go ahead. Get up.
It's about governance. It's divided into sections.
No, one.
It has to do with interaction between the local governance and the global governance. So Mr. Pollmann refers to change the international global system. I would like to know how can you elaborate a little bit more about the ideas from that, and actually there is a paradox because the SDGs are global, but the responsibilities lie on the national governments, like climate change, and there is no binding commitment. So how can you get to the national governments and the local level with their own governance systems to get involved into the SDGs more actively, not only like building plans, because this is something that Professor Duncan Green talks a lot about here in LSE, is that the SDGs, they were somehow implemented at the national level, but only to reach the national plans, but not, there is no accountability on the actual implementation.
Right.
And the private sector, how is the private sector going to get involved in this global governance system, and also in the local level regarding the power of advocacy?
A broad question of governance. Just behind you, please.
My question is very specific. You have a keen interest on sporting events and their sustainability, especially. With the Olympic Games in Rio being just around the corner, with the World Cup having been there 2 years ago, but also the World Cup being in South Africa 6 years ago, there has been a lot of criticism, but also positive reviews about how these sporting media events have influenced the countries and their sustainability. And I was just wondering if it is actually possible, what you're thinking, if mega sporting events can have a significant influence on the sustainability of and the development goals, of the sustainable development goals, and the country's process and development, and if yes, what should they focus on? What can organizations such as FIFA and the IFC, who enter a country to post something, what can they do? What should they focus on, especially for the next few years, to help reach these goals?
Right, okay. I'll just take one and two. Do very quick. You've got to be very quick. Yeah.
A quick question about media coverage.
Media coverage.
When the audience seems to be interested in YouTube videos and cat memes, how do you, as experts, want media to cover issues like sustainable development and climate change so they're more relevant, more fun, and more engaging for the general public?
Okay, and what, last but not least, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very similar question to hers. So my question is about businesses. How are businesses educating the public to about more and more sustainable development?
Okay, we've got lots of debate to round up the meeting. Ella, I'll start with you, actually. Go in a different order.
Okay.
Do you want to go with that? See if that works.
Okay, so I'll actually start with the sport and the media coverage at the same time, because my answer is pretty similar, or has one factor in common, which is Messi, who is one of our 17 Sustainable Development Goal advocates. Mm. So the media coverage, actually, what they've been doing with the SDGs is using celebrities, using well-known names, using people who actually kind of get the media hooked onto the message to be able to deliver that message, right? You may or may not agree with the approach, but it has more or less worked to some degree. And it's definitely engaged an audience which normally would not seek out the Sustainable Development Goals. So that's definitely been an aspect of the media. The second thing the media has done, and one of our fellow advocates, Richard Curtis, who has the Global Goals and the Red Nose Day project, he's British. He did Notting Hill, right? He did Love Actually. Love Actually.
Great movie.
That's the one I know. But he's actually probably one of the bit larger media kind of pallbearers in this, and he's done the logo. He does uses the icon so that you can actually see the effect of what's happening globally on a specific sustainable development goal. So if you're talking, for example, about deforestation, you can have these interactive logos. Another thing we're doing is around the world, it's interesting, it's not just traditional media that's been super important in this. You have also your new technology, but even locally, you have high schools and elementary schools. There are elementary and high schools around the world that are doing sustainable development goal posters. So it really takes one person to kind of get an idea and to go to their principal or to their teacher, whoever it may be, and say, maybe we should do this. In a lot of universities, they now have sustainable development clubs, which are now, you know, kind of really taking the flag and making sure they put enough media in their own community and in their own area. So that's the media coverage. I definitely think to a degree you have to make it exciting for the more traditional media that wants the ratings. But there's also new and innovative ways to do it, right? And that seems to be what's happening a lot. For the sport influence, what's interesting about sporting clubs is that when you have a large sporting event somewhere, oftentimes they have to completely build up the infrastructure for that sporting event. And so if you can get the necessary organizations on board with the sustainable development goals and with making sure that anything that is being built A, in a sustainable way, in an effective way, but that it can be used afterwards. Because one of the huge problems is that you're removing people from their own communities, you're building on top of those communities, they have nowhere to go. But if you can actually ensure that you're not doing that and that whatever is being built can be used down the line as housing or whatever it may be, then I do think that they can have a huge, huge effect. Because we already know that sport in and of itself is one of the greatest unifiers. And so if we could take large sporting events to symbolically be huge moments of sustainable development and something that the whole world can watch, you know, the World Cup in an arena that has been specifically built with this in mind and will later be used as housing for the homeless in that community, I think it would be phenomenal. If you're going to work for FIFA, I recommend you work on that. Change the global governance system. That's a very long conversation. I'm not sure if that means kind of writing off the UN as it is. I think that it makes more sense to attempt to fix the UN because building something new now I don't think would be as capable on a good day. And the reason I say that is there's a lot of conventions, if people know, for example, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and things like that, which were passed in the 1970s, et cetera, that would never pass in the UN today. They wouldn't. I mean, we have a very, very different political environment. And if we were to try to create something new, we would get a lot of the rhetoric would actually be, I think, more radical rhetoric. And I don't think it would have the same agenda that the UN has and would have thought of doing something like the Millennium Development Goals or the Sustainable Development Goals. So I think we should be very careful about writing off the UN. It has very good bits, and we just have to kind of amplify those and recognize why it was created in the first place. Backfires giving to local governments. I don't think giving local ownership ever backfires. It might seem like it backfires in the short term, but it is... When you don't give ownership to local governments, I mean, let's be realistic. How long are you going to stay in a country? How long are you going to maintain the security and the political order of a country? It's completely unsustainable. It's unrealistic. I mean, at one point, the local government has to be given ownership. And whether you give it to them in the beginning or in the end, they're going to go through whatever peaceful or non-peaceful solution to create peace to create some sort of peace in that country. But it has to be done, either in the long or short term. I think companies actually become extremely important. And an example I'll give you is Tunisia, where there was a lot of positive reinforcement from the business community, where they went in and they invested. And because they invested, government stayed in, and there was almost a positive reinforcement of their transition. Whereas in other countries, the second that conflict broke out, the first people you find will leave are actually often businesses. And that sends a message then to governments and to everybody else that this is a no-go situation. So I actually think businesses can be a very, very key initiator of peacefulness in a country or of a peaceful transition. But ultimately, you have to give the ownership to the local community. And we've learned the hard way that Band-Aid solutions are trying to occupy just does not work. I'm not the how can they change it before their silence that was working in a company. I will be honest with you, I just keep talking. So my recommendation would actually be to make sure that you... So my recommendation, and in healthcare we find it very often, when you're a young doctor, you are very quickly silenced. And it's because of a hierarchy that already exists within that system. And so business is very much the same in that sense. But there's always, and I have to believe, that when a good idea is presented, there is no way to say no. If you present a practical, good idea, oftentimes cost-effective idea, then I don't think people can say no. Sometimes they might say it was their idea, but they won't say no. Right? So that would be my suggestion.
Why don't we go a little bit?
I think very quickly, really, on the last two things, innovation is something that young people have in far greater abundance than any other generation at this present moment in time. And it manifests itself through technology, the use of various forms of technology, social media, and so on. And if you look at any company that manages to have young people in it, by the time they do the same things that you have done for centuries in that organization and do it differently, more efficiently, I think you would have no choice. And I'm speaking as someone that works with young people all the time. You'd have no choice but really try to think differently about the problems that you have. And therefore, the pathway into leadership that happens informally because you emerge because of your expertise into, therefore, formal places is what we can begin to look at and study systematically. On the issue of local, on whether things can backfire if you give power to local governments, I think that is the myth that many would have us believe. There is no society that has evolved and stayed and sustained itself for, you know, in perpetuity in that way because of imposition from outside. Things evolve on the ground through the things that you experience and the relationships that you build. And the legitimacy of that local government is what matters. Is the state and is the government an expression of the will of the people around that place? That's what lasts fundamentally in the end. I'll leave it there.
Thanks very much. And last voice to Paul.
I'll keep it very short for the interest of time. But first of all, what can business do in promoting the sustainable development goals? One of the things we have created, in fact, we had a meeting about that today, is the Commission for Business and Sustainable Development. Because one of the things I firmly believe is that for any business who wants to have a long-term success in this society has to be able to show how they positively contribute. The CSR or the less bad type directions don't work anymore. An interesting statistic is that the average life of a publicly traded company now is only 17 years. As the regimes get voted out of office because of corruption or other things, like we've seen with the Arab Spring and other things, companies get voted out of office much quicker than you think now, because they're behaving irresponsibly. Any company that doesn't take care of its value chain or its people and gets exposed sees its market cap go down by 30-40% all the time. Look at the market cap of BP or Volkswagen now, versus it was before. This is a cruel market. And increasingly people are starting to understand that. I personally believe is that if you put an annual report out, and we already tried to do that this year, that you have to publish which goals you are contributing to, realizing that not every business contributes to every goal, but there must be some of these goals that are dominant. Because what the goals are basically is a scorecard of the shortcomings of society. And if we would fulfill these shortcomings, we would all be better off. So I would only want to invest in companies that provide a good future for when I retire and when my children live. I don't want to invest in companies that help make this world worse than it is. So if companies are forced in a positive sense to report around their sustainable development goals, that might change a lot of things. And as consumers, you also have to be careful where you spend your money. You have to do your research and spend your money or buy the shares or do other things behind companies that you believe in the future. I'm very careful on where I put my money or with which companies I deal with from whatever position I am. The companies can also influence their value chain. A company like ours, as in 190 countries, has millions of people in our value chain. We employ probably 4 or 5 million people directly or indirectly around our value chain. So our behaviors, our codes, are a function of also how these other people behave. So we work very hard to do that. If you're in a consumer goods company like ours, use your brands to make the goals come alive. There are activities here that we sponsor globally, like Project Everyone or Global Citizen, to get everybody involved. But we do it with our brands. Our Domestos brand, which is a toilet cleaner, for us it's not a toilet cleaner, it's fighting the issues of open defecation. So the goal of the brand is to build 25 million toilets. Dove is women's self-esteem. So the goal is to give women the same opportunities. A Knorr brand is nutrition. A Lifebuoy brand is hand washing, helping a child reach the age of 5. That's the mission of the brand. So make the brands actually the best spokesmen for the goals. And people rally to that. That's what purpose is, at ultimately translated into action. And so companies have an enormously important role. The reach, if you take a company like ours, we might be the exception because we're a fairly big company. But every day we reach 2 billion people. There is no government in the world that reaches 2 billion people. We're in 7 out of 10 households in the world. There's no government in the world that is in 7 out of 10 households. In most countries we operate, like India or Indonesia or whatever, we reach more households than the post office. So if we can use that reach and scale that we have, it's tremendous. So what do companies have to do with human development? First of all, you have to believe as a company that there is no business case in enduring poverty. If these countries don't develop, we've talked a lot about sub-Sahara countries in Africa, but it's all over the world. You think we're doing well in North Korea? You think we do well if there's a big drought in Brazil? We think you do well in sub-Sahara Africa, where governments don't function? You think we do well in the Middle East right now? Obviously not. So it's in the company's 100% interest, especially if you're a global company, to be sure that you're participating in building these institutions. And we can call it global or local or people here and people there. At the end of the day, the actions need to happen on the ground by everybody. If I am a global company, we are in 190 countries in the world. But all my people in the countries, they might belong to a global company called Unilever, but they're in the countries in the world working for that country. They're local. They're as local as can be. Has nothing to do with a global organization or local. So we want companies to pay tax in countries. Countries that are fragile states often have no capacity to get revenues because they don't have any bargaining power versus many companies. Mining companies would be, extraction industry is a good example of getting a lot of materials from these countries but low levels of revenue. So you have to help build capacity. In fact, some of our biggest projects that we have in the company is to help countries like Nigeria or as far away as Colombia build resilience in their tax departments. Now you might say, why as a company would you do that? Because we want a level playing field. Because we're paying the tax. We want everybody else to pay the tax. And then you build capability. Corruption is another example. For every government that is corrupt, and there are many in this world, there is a corruptor. Who is corrupting the government? And when the government is corrupted, where do they bring their money? Who lets them bring their money? All the money ends up in banks in the West and don't give it back either. All the money that is being paid by someone. So companies have an enormous role to play to be sure that there is no corruption, which probably is one of the biggest evils that is around. Treatment of people, what are fair wages, living wages, modern day slavery. At this moment in the world, unfortunately, I have to report, there are more refugees and displaced people than at any time in the history of mankind. Partly because there are more people in this world, but also partly we are making a mess out of it, and we're pretty good at it. But as a result of those, these people are very vulnerable. There are many people floating around without passports. I was in the Al-Satari camp not long ago in Jordan, where a lot of the Syrians are. They fled, but they didn't take their passport with them. They took their babies with them to be sure that they would survive. They're stateless. And then babies are born in these refugee camps. These have no nationality at all. And these people are moving into Europe now at hundreds of thousands per hour, so to speak. Europe is taking an irresponsible approach to how to deal with this, as far as I'm concerned. And these people are incredibly vulnerable. In this country, and in all other countries in Europe, the numbers of modern-day slavery are going up quite significantly. You wouldn't want to know what is happening in the real world out there. It's fine to be an LSE. And women are totally vulnerable. So companies have to have an absolute duty to ensure that their value chain doesn't have slavery in there. Even if it's difficult. I mean, we get tea from countries, we get cocoa from countries. We know what some of these industries are that are incredibly exposed. We have an obligation to be sure that that is not happening. And if it would be happening, we have to help correct it. We cannot take responsibility for everything because you cannot control the millions of smallholder farmers you deal with. But you certainly have a responsibility to be part of the solution. And consumers have to be aware of that. Transparency will flush that out. I don't want to buy from companies that have slave labor. I don't think it's cool anymore to buy a $1 t-shirt and tell my friends it's very cheap. Now that I know that it comes from the Rana Plaza factory in Bangladesh, which collapsed and 1,050 women lost their lives, innocent women, you know what they got paid? 11 cents an hour. 11 cents an hour. That's about as close as you can get to modern day slavery. The next lowest country was Vietnam at 26 cents an hour. And these women knew that the factory was collapsing. They were forced in it. Why? Because we think it's cool to buy a $1 t-shirt. If we don't start behaving as consumers differently and hold everybody to that level of responsibility or accountability, we're not going to change it. So think about what you do yourselves in all of the things you do and how many things you can influence. And that's true for companies as well. The many companies that have complained against the market and say short-termism and the financial market puts a lot of pressure on us. But what is the financial market? 75% of the financial market is institutional investors investing the pensions for all of us. How are we investing our pension fund? Do you know how LSE is investing its pension funds for its professors? Have they signed up to the principles of responsible investment? Have they a decarbonization movement? Have they a commitment to ensure that they only invest in companies that provide transparency in their value chain and slavery? That's the question you have to ask. The world is being changed by all of us one at a time. Coming to millennials and how they change companies, it's actually very interesting, and I'm not so worried about that. Because only about one third of the millennials that are graduating from universities right now in the US want to work for big companies. They don't trust them. They don't trust CEOs either. I'm actually sitting here as one of the lowest trusted members of the panel.
Well, I think and you're going to get a lot of job applications.
No, no, I'm probably will. But millennials don't want to work for companies anymore. And then if people go into companies, only about one third of their energy is tapped. People feel that the working time is actually a negative time. People are not happy to go to work. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that the individual values are not aligned with the values you find at work. Mm-hmm. We go out of our homes and kiss our babies goodbye and tell to our wives or husbands, I love you, and want them to have a happier, better life. And then we go into an environment where we basically rip off people. Mm-hmm. We sell them insurances that we wouldn't sell to our mothers. We pollute the carbon because someone else is paying for it, so let's pollute the world so I can make more money. Because I don't have to pay for it. We have cheap labor on our payroll so that our products are more profitable. So people are conflicted. It's, by the way, one of the main reasons you get the issues of mental wellness issues that are currently going on or people disengaging from the work process. So companies are finding out now that obviously they can only survive if they get the best quality people. At the end of the day, it's all about people. In Unilever, I only have one key indicator that I do worry about, which is to be sure that in every country where we operate, we are the number one employer. It happens to be that in 80% of the countries that we measure now, we are the number one employer. On LinkedIn, after Google and Apple, we are the third most looked up company on LinkedIn, which is ridiculous because we're Unilever. It's not a brand name. So I've not been able to explain it to my 89-year-old mother either. But we get about 1.8 million applicants a year just applying to Unilever. Because of our purpose, our business model that they want to be part of. Because the young people say, yeah, it's fine that I'm in this world, but I definitely want to touch people positively and leave this world in a little bit better place than I found it. I want to work for a company that has a purpose. And if companies don't unlock that, they're going to be toast. They're part of this 17-year statistic, I'm telling you. So there is an economic necessity that is going to drive this. And then secondly, technology. The time that the boss had the knowledge and that's why he was the boss is absolutely over now. In fact, I always say to people, I'm the one that knows the least in my company. I might be the CEO, but everybody can have my title because it doesn't do anything to me. But I know the least. My finance director knows more about finance than I do. The one who runs the UK, there's a lady who runs the UK for us, she knows more about the UK than I do. The person that works on the hand washing programs for Lifebuoy knows more than I do. So I frankly don't know much. So the only thing I can do is be sure that our system works by including everybody. And the millennials, right now, because of all the way that they've grown up in a power-dead even society, in my opinion, in that sense, have an enormous capacity to unlock the potential in the companies with their knowledge, their creativity, their access to technology, which is becoming more important. One of the biggest changes is in this area of fourth industrial revolution is the Airbnbs and the Ubers, and by the way, all run by people that are between 15 and 16 years old. Mark Zuckerberg was, you know, because they all quit college anyway when they start, and they're about 17 years old. And they say, you know, such you, I'll do it myself. And they change the world. And all these disruptors are actually young people. There are a few exceptions, obviously, but they're people that are below 25 years old. And we have sort of this image that if we do things, the sustainable development goals or other things, the young people don't get a seat at the table. They should be actually leading it. The next 15 years is when you're going from 25 years old to 40 years old. These are the deciding years in your life. You should be at the head of the table, and we should be supporting you. We've goofed up, to be honest, our generation. Not willfully, because a lot of these issues weren't apparent, but we certainly haven't provided the solutions. Unfortunately, this world is 2 billion years old, but in the last 200 years, or 3 billion years old, in the last 200 years, we've done more damage than the previous 3 billion years by not being very mindful of how we need to live in harmony with nature. It happens to be that the millennials have a different sense of that. And it's obviously, for that reason, nearly a must to put them in charge. Jeanne d'Arc on the Seats of Orleans was 17 years old. Richard Branson, when he started, was 17 years old. And, you know, many of the people that changed the history were below 20. And even today, again, many business people, Jack Ma's or the Pony Ma's of Tencent or Alibaba's, if you come from the Chinas of this world, these guys were all in the early 20s, and they're changing the world. So you'd be stupid as a business not to capitalize on that. Yeah. I had one event, and that's my last comment. Yeah. I had one event on Tuesday night that we created with the Prince of Wales. I have a lot of respect for the Prince of Wales because he was ahead of his time. Got a lot of criticism for that, but he understood organic farming. He understood sustainability. His Prince's Trust does wonderful work in this country. I don't really have to advertise him because he earns his merits by what he's actually doing and delivering. So I asked him to be the patron of the Young, we call it Unilever, but Young Sustainable Entrepreneur Award. Every year now we get 1,000 social enterprises applying for this award. What they value most is training and mentoring that they get and being linked into our value chains. And obviously there's a little bit of money, but what they value most is in fact these intangibles. And if you see what the solutions are that these people bring to driving the development agenda, it is the key to unlock the potential for a company like ours in the future. I would be very worried if I wouldn't have that. We have thousands now tied into our value chains, and they are actually changing the company. We send every year a few hundred people to these young networks. There are an incredible amount of young networks in the world. WeDay, Enactus, Global Shapers, Ashoka Fellows, and I could go on. But they are not connected. If we could connect all the young networks, you're all sitting here with your tweets and you have your Facebooks, you all have hundreds of followers or thousands of people that see what you're doing. If you could connect your networks of young people, we're up and running. I can tell you, we're up and running. So leverage those. Don't be shy and demand that you're sitting at the head of the table, not even at the table.
Okay, on that optimistic note, I think we'll say thank you very much. I'd just like to thank the people who did all the organization for this tonight, Marta and Joe and others from LSE Ideas. If you want to follow what we do in LSE Ideas, just go to our website, and this will also be put up as a podcast. Another broad round of applause for all of our speakers from King's, from Allah, and from Joe. Thank you very much.